From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Well, right whale conservationists have ended up exactly where they did not want to be, in an escalating battle between lobstermen and scientists. North Atlantic right whales are critically endangered. There are only about 400 remaining, and that number is falling. Entanglement in fishing gear is the leading cause of death. And in April of this year, a broad group of stakeholders agreed to new commitments to reduce the amount of rope in coastal waters, with the aim of cutting right whale deaths by at least 60%. But the Maine Lobstermen's Association has since withdrawn its support. Public officials from Maine have also chimed in, demanding science-based policies. Meanwhile, more than a dozen scientists have signed a letter asserting that the April agreement was based on the best science available. Fred Bever is a reporter who's been covering this issue for Maine Public Radio. Fred, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
This story, of course, goes back decades, but if we go back just a couple of years, first in 2017 and again this year, the summer in particular was very deadly. More than a dozen deaths in 2017, we're up to 10 this year, and a real sense of urgency that we could see this species go extinct within our lifetime. And so in April, this large group, the Take Reduction Team, got together and agreed to make some significant rule changes to try to address this situation. What was it they actually agreed to?
Well, first to describe the group briefly, it's made up of stakeholders from all sectors. It's lobstermen, it's whale scientists, it's federal and state regulators, it's conservation groups. They all got together under being convened by the feds to try to come up with solutions. What they came up with in Providence in April was this idea of reducing risk of not only mortality, but also serious injury to the whales by 60%, that if that could be achieved, then the whales would stand a chance of not going on this steady trajectory towards extinction.
And just to be absolutely clear, the Maine Lobstermen's Association had representatives at those negotiations and voted for this agreement, right?
There were four lobstermen. There were also some scientists, state regulator on the panel, and Patrice McCarron, who is the executive director of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. Now, although they agreed to it, they said, we are doing this under the gun. During that four-day meeting, a top federal official from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, according to the participants, told the entire group, you will reach 60% risk reduction or we will do it for you. Hmm. And so it was under that pressure that the Maine delegation, and they were very vociferous about this. They said, we don't like this, but we're going to do it. Some of them said, some of the lobstermen said, we think we can do this, but we reserve our right to come back at this, which made some of the conservationists not very happy, but it was called a near consensus.
Well, so that then triggered, this is a formal federal rulemaking process that includes a public comment period. And what we have seen during this public comment period is Maine Lobstermen's Association using that right that they said they reserved to come back to this. And in August into early September, Maine Lobstermen's Association withdrew their support. You said they were already, they had reservations, they did this under the gun, but what specifically did they cite as a reason for withdrawing support for the agreement they had voted for?
Well, all along, the Maine delegation has been expressing concerns about the model that NOAA introduced pretty late in the game, like not until early April or just before, that assesses risks and assigns different kinds of reduction benefits from different methodologies. And NOAA even now is still refining that and working on it. So right out of the gate, this was one of their big concerns. Since then, Patrice McCarron at the Maine Lobstermen's Association has done her own analysis, dug back into NOAA data, and she says it's flawed. She says that things were missed. Data was incomplete. For instance, there was one mortality of a whale that was attributed to lobster gear entanglement, but she says it actually was gill nets, and that can change the calculations. She has several other issues. She thinks that gill nets are actually a greater risk, and they're not getting enough attention. Basically, an array of issues. There's one thing that's important to understand in this difference in views between the lobstermen on one side and the scientists and the conservationists on the other, and it has to do with how you take a look at risk. The conservationists and scientists will tell you, basically, you have to assume that the whales could be present anywhere in the Gulf of Maine and that they are. And so even if there's a very small likelihood that a whale will end up in waters off of Maine, with all of that rope that's in the water, even one swimming through, if it just gets entangled in one rope, its risk of injury is very, very high. And you can't even lose one whale a year and avoid extinction. You have, according to the federal calculations, you can lose one whale every 2 years, and then it can stay on a path of sustainability. And we're far above that right now.
It seems to be that the Maine delegation across the board is saying we need different science that comes to a new conclusion. And the Maine Department of Marine Resources has actually gotten involved and proposed another different rule that would require that Maine lobster gear be uniquely marked so that it could be identified if it's involved in a right whale entanglement. What kind of response has that idea gotten?
Well, there was consensus at the take reduction team amongst all the states that this was something that needed to be done at this point. In the past, my understanding is that Maine has resisted unique gear markings. Now they're moving towards it. And I spoke recently to Genevieve McDonald. She's a lobsterman from Stonington, Maine, which is the king of the lobster boom. They're bringing in $50 million worth of lobster now that the population has really moved down east to where this island of Stonington is. And she's also a representative to the state legislature.
We need gear marking. I hate to say it, but the industry really didn't want gear marking. But I think we made a mistake by not having individual markings specific to our region.
And now the state of Maine has started its own rulemaking to enact those gear marking measures.
Well, and as you mentioned, some of Maine's elected officials have also weighed in during this federal public comment period about those federal rules that were proposed and agreed to in April, saying that what's actually needed is, quote, science-based policy, suggesting that this proposal that was agreed to was not science-based. But the same day that the Maine delegation put out that announcement, a dozen and a half scientists responded with a letter to Senator Collins reiterating the science that was involved in getting to that agreement and that underpins those proposed measures. And we spoke with Scott Landry of the Center for Coastal Studies. He says there's really good science behind the agreement. Obviously, we don't know everything, as you've highlighted. There are big questions that may be unanswerable because the gear is just not there to, you know, attribute blame for a given entanglement. But for example, the center did a study in 2005 that looked at all of the gear that they had found on both humpback and North Atlantic right whales and found that, in fact, the lobster industry is a problem. Here's Scott Landry.
And 40% of that gear was lobster gear for right whales. And so it's definitely the single largest amount of fishery that we've pulled off of right whales over the years. But of course, right whales got entangled in just about everything. But to state that lobster is not a significant portion of that would not be correct.
So obviously he's in support of at least what was agreed to, this aiming for a 60% reduction. But there was, interestingly, one person on that take reduction team back in April who did not vote for the proposed measures. That was Sharon Young of the Humane Society. And she actually didn't vote for it because she doesn't think it goes far enough. And you've spoken with her. She actually alleges that the Maine Lobstermen's Association's change of heart has largely been motivated by pressure from the Maine Lobstermen's Union. Let's hear from Sharon Young.
The time to have stood up and said, no, we can't support this, would have been in the take reduction team, rather than waiting till after the take reduction team, when the Maine Lobstermen's Union approached politicians and got political forces involved.
Fred Bever, you've already noted that the Maine Lobstermen's Association voted for the agreement, saying that they felt like they had a gun to their head. From your reporting, how much of a role has the Maine Lobstermen's Union, this other group, played in applying pressure and perhaps resulting in this public withdrawal of support?
Well, the union is smaller than the association, maybe scrappier, maybe a little more inflammatory. They were much more vocal at that rally in Stonington that I mentioned. And so there's friction between the two groups. And it's not something they like to talk to the press about, but you can see it in social media and elsewhere that friction is there.
Where does the process go from here? I mean, we've got these extreme tensions that you're mentioning between lobstermen in Maine and the rest of the take reduction team, potential tensions between the U.S. and Canada. There are multiple lawsuits being brought against federal officials, against the state of Maine, alleging failure to do enough to protect right whales. I mean, this is a very heated and complex mix at this point.
And those lawsuits are proceeding. A big one that was filed back in 2018 by several of the conservation groups, including Sharon Young's Humane Society, the Conservation Law Foundation, the Center for Biological Diversity. They all filed separate suits. They were consolidated in one that's now making its way through the courts. And many observers think that that's really what's putting the pressure on the feds to move this process along as much as anything. Whether the politicians here could bring any pressure in the Capitol to affect the process is an open question.
That's Fred Bever. He's a reporter with Maine Public Radio who's been covering the lobster fishing industry and efforts to better protect North Atlantic right whales. Fred, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, new studies in mice may help explain why people are showing up in emergency rooms with lung damage from chronic vaping. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Government officials have warned people to avoid e-cigarettes after several people have died and hundreds of otherwise healthy people have ended up in emergency rooms across the country with lung damage that appears to be linked to vaping. The illness has been dubbed mysterious, but new research may help explain what's going on. A study exposing mice to some of the chemicals used in e-cigarettes resulted in lung damage similar to what's being seen in people in hospitals. Farah Karadmand is professor of pulmonary medicine at Baylor College of Medicine and senior author on that newly published work. Farah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this work being published in the past couple of weeks has garnered a lot of headlines, a lot of attention, seems very timely, but obviously a study like this does not happen overnight. This is something you've been working on for years. So where did this work originate? What gave you the idea that you might need to look into this and start looking at damaging effects of vaping?
That's a great question. Yes, none of this study actually could have been accomplished had it not been for a question that we raised about 4 years ago when we saw several publications back to back showing that the mice, laboratory animals exposed to vaping, accumulate the same kind of inflammatory cells in their lungs that are reminiscent of cigarette smoke exposure. So again, the surprise of this story is that while we expected to observe an effect of nicotine-containing vape material or exposure to vape with nicotine, our two negative controls in our thought were the ones that were just going to get the vape juice, right? Or what they, in the lay term, they call it e-juice, meaning electronic solvents where you put your nicotine in it. And then our second group was just mice that were exposed to filtered air. So we thought, okay, those are two control groups, and then the other two are the one we're going to do side by side. But the surprise of the story came when my graduate student, Matthew Madison, he came to my office and said, you know, Dr. Kratman, I can't find any evidence that the vape exposure mice, they don't really show any evidence for inflammation as far as I could see in their lungs. But here's what I found. The macrophages, or these immune cells that are your first line of defense, they appear to look very different than mice that have been exposed to air or cigarette smoke. And so that sort of was our first evidence that, well, we're looking at something that these mice have been, you know, uniformly exposed to, which is the solvent, because with or without nicotine, these cells look exactly the same.
So what is in, as you called it, vape juice? What are these solvents that are being used in e-cigarettes if that appears to be what is affecting the lungs of the mice exposed to it, as opposed to the nicotine or the cannabis or whatever else is put in there, or the flavors for that matter? If it's really just that basic solvent, what are those chemicals?
So they're called propylene glycol and vegetable glycerol, or just you know, short glycerol. In fact, we didn't really make this up. We actually went to a vape shop in Houston and asked, what are the most common e-juice used in when you sell these products. And they said, oh, yeah, that's easy. That's PGVG, so propylene glycol vegetable glycerol, which is the combination of which it is sort of been manipulated to a point where vapors feel they get a very good hit in their lungs. They feel that something is going in, and they feel it's the same kind of feeling as a cigarette smoke inhalation gives you, that you feel like something is really going down to your lungs. So they've perfected that ratio, PGVG ratio, to simulate smoking. Ratio that we use is exactly what, again, being used commercially.
Farah Karadmand, walk us through exactly what it was you saw. I mean, you're exposing these mice to, you know, they're breathing essentially vape juice. Were they dropping dead? Did you have to go really searching for the effects? How obvious were they? And how much do those effects mirror what we're seeing in humans showing up in emergency rooms?
So exactly. So it was brought to my attention that, in fact, this is now as early as 2011, 2012, case reports of heavy vapors presenting with shortness of breath and finding things in their lungs that resemble what we call in clinics lipoid pneumonia, meaning that excess lipid in the lungs being accumulated. And so when I looked at those images and I looked at Matthews, and we sort of thought, well, you know, I wonder if what we were looking at is what's been actually, at least in case reports, as early, like I said, as, you know, even before we started our experiment, is it the same pathway? And the other thing is that, you know, reading these case reports, they had presumed that the glycerol, which is, you know, a vegetable type of oil, extracted from vegetable oil, is what's accumulating in the lungs of these patients that are showing in emergency rooms. And again, it was so rare and so new that was being reported as case reports. And then they presumed that it's the glycerol in the vape material, and they would tell the patients to stop vaping, and most often, and they would fare better. So then we sort of started chasing after, well, is it the glycerol that is in PGVG, again, the VG part of it being glycerol, is this what's accumulating in the macrophages?
And is it?
It is not. And that is actually in our paper showing that our first line of thought was that, is it the same material that is, again, in humans, nobody had measured it. They had just presumed it is what that glycerol is. And we were very surprised to find that these lipids that are accumulating are the type that the body generates, meaning that it is what we call endogenous form of lipid, not exogenous. Exogenous being what something from coming from outside, meaning there would have been potentially the glycerol that was in the vape juice. What we found was that no, indeed, these are called phosphatidylcholines, and these are the type of lipids that are generated by body and being incorporated into a lining fluid of your lung, which, by the way, continuously gets reabsorbed and remade in order for this lining fluid to properly function. And one of the functions of this lining fluid is your first line of defense against anything that invades the lung.
So what is the end result of this lung damage? How does having this extra lipid building up that your body is producing and you know, putting into these cells, what kind of health effects does that actually have?
So again, that was the next line of experiments, because what we were observing, just like 99.99% of vapors out there, which they don't necessarily feel there's anything wrong with them. And our mice actually did not lose weight. They did not look sick. But what happened was when we isolated the cells from the lungs of mice that were exposed to vape with or without nicotine, again, independent of nicotine, the cells behaved the same way, but they were incapable of responding to what would be an alarming molecule, which is a piece of virus or a piece of bacteria. Mm. They were not behaving as if they were not seeing it.
I mean, these are immune cells, and they're no longer acting like immune cells and doing their job to fight a virus.
Exactly. Even though the mice are running around, eating, performing their bodily function just fine, their immune cells were, again, now not working well. And so what we then to then test the hypothesis that if these cells that we're looking at them outside their body are not functioning well or not seeing bacteria or viruses correctly, what if we infect them? And so what happens then? And that's basically what is the crux of the paper, is that, yes, while they look fine, but if they cannot handle viruses, because even a very small dose of influenza virus, which we introduced to these cohorts of mice, they were not able to handle it. They had quite a bit of immune cells coming into the lungs. And at the same time, a significant portion of these mice succumbed to their infection.
They died as a result of an exposure to a small amount of flu virus.
Correct.
So your research has shown that chronically breathing in vape juice changes these immune cells, these macrophages, and their ability to do their job to fight a virus. And you're saying that we see essentially the same symptoms and the cells look the same in humans coming into ERs after they have vaped. And I have to wonder how we got here. If these chemicals that are in vape juice are this dangerous, how did we not know this before these products went on the market?
Well, so propylene glycol and vegetable glucose are currently used in medicine. They're solvents. They are FDA approved. For instance, propylene glycol in particular is a very good solvent, and which a lot of medications that are require strong solvents are used. So in the intensive care unit, for instance, we have a lot of patients that receive medication and they are dissolved in propylene glycol. Now, we are very careful because we know propylene glycol has side effects, and so we only limit the amount of propylene glycol used in each case to 24 hours, at the most 72 hours, in order to minimize the amount of metabolic changes that these can induce. But nonetheless, all of this is intravenous. We have never ever, or FDA has never ever, even tested or been asked to determine whether these things, these chemical solvents, are actually safe as in a form of inhalational, let alone chronic inhalation.
I mean, that seems like an enormous oversight. It doesn't take somebody with an advanced degree in toxicology to know that drinking water is different than breathing water. How can a product be approved without knowing if the chemicals are safe to breathe?
Good question.
Farah Karadmand, where do we go from here? I mean, you're talking about a relatively small number of studies that you have done in your lab, showing these effects in mice, showing effects that are similar to the case studies that we have in humans from emergency rooms. But that's still a fairly small body of work. What more do we need? And what kind of response might be appropriate to what we know at this point?
Well, I mean, basically, this pretty much opened a can of worms. So we need to know which component is it. Is it the really the ratio that is most commonly purchased or commercialized? Is this ratio what's causing this? Or is it a propylene glycol? But it could be also vegetable glycerol alone. So we need to separate these things out. We need to do some really careful studies to see which components and to what degree they are causing this problem. And then alternatively, we need to know, well, okay, so now that we know they do poison the cells, when does it clear, or does it clear? The other thing is that more than half of the cases of some of the most severely ill people that have been in the hospital, the solvents that were used also contain vitamin E acetate. So one of the big questions my lab is trying to focus on is to understand the vitamin E acetate component that could be something that perhaps exaggerates what we see chronically.
That's Farah Karadmand. She's a professor of pulmonary medicine at Baylor College of Medicine and senior author on a new study documenting lung damage in mice who chronically inhaled some of the chemicals used in e-cigarettes. Farah Karadmand, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's officially fall and temperatures have turned cooler, but one unwelcome part of summer continues to linger, and that's the risk of the mosquito-borne triple E virus. Massachusetts state's officials this past week confirmed an 8th case of triple E in the Commonwealth, and one person died from the virus in August. There have also been cases and fatalities from triple E in Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Michigan. While triple E infections are rare, they can be deadly, and the risk will continue until there's a hard frost to kill off mosquitoes. Tanya Kolpitz is a researcher at the National Emerging Infectious Diseases Laboratories at Boston University, and she joins me now to talk through what we know about this unusual virus. Tanya, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So triple E stands for Eastern Equine Encephalitis. Equine suggesting horses are involved. Obviously, it's mosquito-borne, and we've also heard, this year a lot about the fact that it tends to be birds that mosquitoes are picking the virus up from. Can you just give us the life cycle of this virus?
So the cycle is maintained in nature between birds and bird-feeding mosquitoes, the Culicetta. And it's thought that sometimes these Culicetta mosquitoes will bite an incidental feeding source, such as a horse or a human, and that's when they become infected. But they're known as dead-end or incidental hosts for the triple E virus because a mosquito cannot pick up the virus from them.
And you've mentioned this Culicetta mosquito tends to bite birds. Obviously, we have different kinds of mosquitoes around. This is not the one that's mostly biting us, right?
So that is actually a good research question right now. It's traditionally been thought that there were more anthrophilic or mammal-biting mosquitoes involved in transmitting triple E to horses and humans from the birds. But recent studies have suggested that from sampling, the virus is almost exclusively found in high levels in Culicetta mosquitoes. So now it really poses the question, are these Culicetta mosquitoes incidentally biting horses and humans, or is there indeed a so-called bridge vector of mammal-biting mosquito that's getting the virus from the birds?
Wow, so we don't actually really know for sure the full life cycle and transmission cycle of this virus.
Exactly. And a lot more research needs to be done. And that's one of the issues is there's limited funding for research into this virus because it's so rare. Cases are so rare in humans. And sometimes it's thought of as an exclusively East Coast problem. So national funding can be hard to get for things like that.
Well, Tanya Kolpitz mentioning that this is perceived as an East Coast problem. I mean, the Great Lakes, Michigan is another place where we see a hot spot. But we tend to think of mosquito-borne illnesses as being primarily tropical things. Do we know why southern New England and the Great Lakes might be hotspots for this particular mosquito-borne virus?
So that's a good question. So mosquito-borne viruses typically follow the habitats of the mosquitoes that transmit them. So for example, Aedes aegypti is probably the most prolific mosquito vector of human viral disease, spreading Zika, dengue, yellow fever, chikungunya, and that is restricted to the tropics because of the Aedes aegypti habitat. That mosquito can't overwinter. Where for triple E, you have the Culicetta mosquito involved in a transmission cycle with birds, and that mosquito is adapted to overwintering. So that's why this virus can be found in the northern hemisphere.
You say it's adapted to overwintering, but state officials have said, you know, that this risk will essentially end with the first hard frost. So what happens at that point?
So at that point, the adult mosquitoes will die and the eggs will overwinter and hatch during rain in the next season. So that's what I mean by overwintering, is that the mosquito life cycle can survive a winter, whereas other types of mosquitoes cannot. But when the first hard frost does arrive and start killing off the adults, then it's almost sort of a hibernation period for the mosquitoes.
And do we understand why we see outbreaks of triple E like every several years? It doesn't seem to be a constant thing or just constantly getting more prevalent. You know, we hadn't seen a season like this for several years. And now we've got, maybe a dozen or more cases and a few fatalities across the country. Do we have any idea what determines when we're going to have a bad triple E season?
So no, more research needs to go into that as well. It's not entirely known. There have been some theories looking at historical data So you need, it's thought that you need a rainy fall followed by a rainy late spring, early summer. And then that August, there may be an emergence of Tripoli among mammals. So it's really the number of mosquitoes. So the more rain, the more mosquitoes you'll have, and the greater number of Culiceta mosquitoes, the greater the transmission of Tripoli in the natural cycle and the greater a chance of emergence into mammals.
Tanya Kolpitz, Tripoli is rare, but when infections happen, I mean, this is a really scary virus because of how deadly it can be. But it's also kind of interesting, when you look at people who have been infected, like only 1 in 20 people show any symptoms at all. But then among those who do show symptoms, something like a third or a half actually die from the virus. Do we have any idea why the effects of the infection can be so different between people?
So that's a good question. And again, it's going to take a lot of research to really get to the answer. It's going to depend on each individual's immune system and response, as well as the pathogenesis of the virus. So we know if the virus does take a neuroinvasive route, your chances of having there be a fatality are much higher.
So if it gets into your brain.
Yes, if it gets into the brain. But in 2011, nationwide, there were 4 cases of Triple E. 3 of those died. So it was 75% fatal. And in 2015, 4 of 6 cases died. So it's 67% fatal. But then you'll have years where it'll be, 10 to 20% fatal. So I think the average is around 40%. It's a numbers game with each individual case. And there's no specific antiviral treatment, but how soon, were they taken in to care? How strong is their immune system? We suspect that in children and elderly, it's going to be a harder fight.
And as you mentioned, it's the brain infection that really can be deadly, and in particular, the swelling in the brain. Is there something particular about the way that Triple E affects the brain, or is just brain swelling across the board something for which we don't have a very good treatment?
So we don't have a very good treatment for a lot of neuroinvasive viral infections because of the blood-brain barrier. It's a protected zone that it's hard to get medication into. And there's also the issue that, once a virus reaches the brain and infects all of those cells, it's really hard to turn it back. It's really hard to overcome that damage.
Some mosquito-borne viruses can be passed person to person. Tripoli is not one of those, right?
Correct. So for one of these viruses to be passed person to person, well, for most of them, you do need a mosquito vector. And in the case of Triple E, human beings don't have enough virus replication in their system. That's why they're considered dead-end hosts. So a mosquito actually can't pick up virus infection from an infected person. So it sort of ends there.
Tanya Kolpitz, we mentioned earlier the fact that horses and also some other livestock can get infected with Tripoli. Obviously, the equine part in the name there. There's actually at least one vaccine for horses. What about humans?
So there is a vaccine for horses, and it's really effective. There was some research into a vaccine for humans, but it sort of died away. I think there's just not enough demand for that. The amount of money that it would take with research and the R&D that, pharmaceutical companies or vaccine companies would have to put into this, they wouldn't get, the reimbursement model just isn't there. There's not enough demand. How many people and how many states would vaccinate, especially with the current, wave of anti-vaccination fervor? It's not sure how many people would actually utilize this.
Well, Tanya Kolpitz, you, though, have been working on potential vaccination strategies that might not just protect individuals, but actually stop the cycle of transmission. Tell us about that work.
So one of our research projects is into so-called transmission-blocking vaccines. And the way these work is to stop transmission from humans to mosquitoes and from mosquitoes to humans. So the best viruses to target with this sort of transmission-blocking vaccine methodology are the systemic arboviruses like Zika, yellow fever, and dengue that are spread by Aedes aegypti mosquitoes. Since they don't need another zoonotic reservoir host, you can break the transmission cycle between mosquito and human or human and mosquito and basically stop infection in humans. And the way we do that is by targeting a protein required for infection in the mosquito, and then humans make antibodies against that protein. Mosquitoes feed on these antibodies, which then bind their own protein and stop the virus from infecting. So we effectively immunize the mosquitoes.
Is there any way that that kind of strategy could be used against Tripoli, or is the fact that, you know, it's birds and then horses that are being bitten mostly that means it's just not really feasible?
Yeah, so that's why it might not be feasible for Tripoli, because birds are involved in the main transmission cycle. So if you vaccinated, say, horses or humans, the number of Culicetta mosquitoes that would take up those antibodies would be much too low, I think, to break the transmission cycle. So in the case of Triple E, to stop transmission, you would really have to put a break in the cycle between mosquitoes and birds. So that's a whole nother arm of research.
Tanya Kolpitz, in addition to studying Triple E, you live in the Boston area. You are in a Triple E-affected area, and we hear advice on what steps to take to protect ourselves using insect repellents or avoiding outdoor activity. And I'm curious, as someone who knows this virus about as well as anybody, what kinds of steps do you take?
So I think I'm taking the same steps as recommended for anybody else, really, using insect repellent with DEET, wearing long pants and trying to avoid mosquito bites, getting rid of any standing water around my house. We actually live on the North Shore, which is not one of the high-risk areas, but I have a young son, and we don't go out, you know, at dusk. We don't go out after dinner anymore, just because, I mean, it's incredibly rare, but it only takes one mosquito.
That's Tanya Kolpitz. She is a researcher at the National Emerging Infectious Diseases Laboratories at the Boston University, where she studies mosquito-borne illnesses. Tanya, thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, a new report finds Northeast states are trying to make their climate policies fair and equitable, but they need better ways to measure that. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Climate change is real, it's human-caused, and it will affect everyone. But the impacts will vary from place to place and person to person. And already, there are major disparities in climate impacts. For example, women are disproportionately impacted, as are those with limited financial resources. Theoretically, that means that policies aimed at limiting climate change should disproportionately benefit those people, but that's not always the case. For example, market-based solutions that might result in increased energy prices are a disproportionate burden for those already at a financial disadvantage. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGI for short, is a carbon cap-and-trade program for the energy sector. There are currently 9 member states in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, and not surprisingly, many of those states also have other climate policies and programs in place. Recently, a group of independent researchers decided to see whether and how REGGI states are addressing the issue of equity in their climate policies. Jean Herb is the executive director of the Environmental Analysis and Communications Group at Rutgers University, and she's the lead author on that new report. Jean, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Heather.
Jean, we tend to think of climate equity often on these global scales, right? That developing nations are more impacted than, say, the United States. But give us some examples of how disparities in climate impacts can play out right here in the United States, in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic regions.
Here in the United States, even the 4th National Climate Assessment tells us that low-income communities and communities of color are less likely to have the resources and the capacity to prepare for and recover from extreme climate events. It's widely accepted and well documented that while all people are affected by a changing climate, that some populations are disproportionately affected. And that includes communities of color, people who are lower income, indigenous populations, seniors, people with chronic health conditions, outdoor workers. So when you think about it, if you can't afford to buy an air conditioner and you live in a city that has less trees and is a lot hotter than a suburban area, and if you have asthma, increased ground-level ozone as a result of high heat days may send you to the emergency room, and more likely than not, you're not going to have insurance. If you work an hourly wage job and you can't get to it because the roads are closed due to flooding, you're just not going to get paid. If English is not your first language, your ability to take advantage of recovery and social services after an extreme weather event are going to be totally limited. It's also clear that certain populations suffer from what's referred to as energy poverty, and that low-income populations, African Americans, Latinos, and others, including renters, spend a larger portion of their income on home energy costs than do other households. And as a result, what we're seeing is this heat or eat phenomena.
That's the inequity, for the most part, in the impacts of climate change. But then there's also the fact that while we would think that addressing climate change should then benefit those people, those are often the groups that are disproportionately disadvantaged by some of our climate policies. So give us some examples of how that plays out.
Well, some of what we're starting to see here is that states and cities have been and are continuing to lead the way in the United States with regard to policy. In the first 6 months of 2019 alone, five of the 11 states that we looked at passed new climate laws. Within the region that we looked at, most of the states have set aggressive limits to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by the middle of the century. And these are generally informed by science in terms of the limits that we need to achieve to be able to forestall the worst impacts of climate change. The issues become, how do we achieve those limits in ways that deliver the benefits from reducing emissions to the populations and to the communities that are not only most impacted, but in ways that improve the communities that these people live in so that they're healthier, more prosperous, greener, and more equitable.
Why wouldn't simply reducing greenhouse gas emissions, any policy that would do that, accomplish that benefit to the communities most impacted by climate change? How could a well-intentioned policy aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions end up causing unfair and disproportionate impacts?
There's concerns in the environmental justice community that some policies, particularly policies that establish broad caps on carbon dioxide emission, that we may see individual power plants increase emissions and that those increased emissions might occur in places where there are already historic disproportionate environmental burdens. So that's one area of concern. Another area of concern, for example, is that if we're looking at developing, for example, transportation policies that are aimed at reducing transportation emissions, which is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions here in the United States, that we need to think about who are the populations that we're aiming at. If we're thinking, for example, at electric vehicles, it is unlikely that something such as an electric vehicle rebate program is going to have significant penetration on a very low-income population, because more often than not, those populations are going to be relying on mass transit. And so the challenge for policymakers is to be able to look at complementing policies such as community rideshare programs or electric mass transit, such as electric buses, that can benefit low-income populations as well. What the states are realizing is that they're not going to meet their state climate targets, those emission targets, unless they also aggressively direct their state climate programs to those disadvantaged communities.
Well, Jean Herb, you are part of a group of independent academic researchers who have looked at the role that equity issues are playing in state climate policies, specifically in the states that are within the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. How did you actually assess whether or not a policy was equitable?
Well, I think from the get-go, what I have to stress is this was not a project where we were evaluating the efforts of the states. We looked at 11 states in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, as well as two states outside the region and two cities outside of the region. And it would have been very difficult to do something that was an evaluation, quite frankly, for a couple reasons. One is because this is a relatively new area, and we would not have had a benchmark to measure to, but also because the states are very, very diverse. Disadvantage in one state may have a focus on, for example, the rural poor, such as in Vermont, while in another state, the focus might be on communities with disproportionate environmental impacts. Or in another state, the focus might be on underemployed former fossil fuel workers. So we didn't do a comparison. What we did was we did a snapshot. And it was fascinating. What we found, we referred to it kind of as a period of innovation, not because we're seeing this major revolution in policy right now, but rather because we're seeing a novelty in pilot and demonstration efforts, and that those pilots and innovations will inform their experiences as they scale up.
As you look at all of these different states from your 30,000-foot vantage point, are there emerging best practices or lessons about what works and what doesn't?
Mm-hmm. So one thing certainly that comes across is that leadership from the top matters, and that while it might sound sort of commonsensical, it's important to say this, and it's important to reinforce it. We found that when mandates are set, such as directing that a certain portion of solar energy be directed to low-income households, that the agencies then really have this long leash to innovate. We also found that when the states establish mandates for the utilities, then innovation occurs as well. Another thing that we found is that process matters. And I know that sounds kind of silly, but it's true. As members of the public, we've all have a story about some time when we went to talk to some faceless bureaucrat. But what we're seeing now is that the states and the cities in our study are trying to find new ways to engage the public so that the public is actually heard and truly listened to.
Jean Herb, what I'm hearing you say is that for policies to end up being truly equitable and for them to benefit the most vulnerable communities, equity has to be a focus from the beginning. Can you give us perhaps just one example of a policy and a process that you think exemplifies that?
Here's an interesting example. There's a program in the state of Massachusetts that's called the Solar Massachusetts Renewable Target Program. Lots of the states are developing community renewable programs because community renewable programs recognize that it's difficult for a low-income renter or a low-income homeowner to afford to put solar panels on their roofs.
I mean, if you're already in energy poverty, as you said, if you're already struggling just to pay your electricity or heating bill, adding on for solar panels is just not in the picture.
Correct. So in a community solar program, the subscriber, the person, you and I, essentially buys into a solar project. And more often than not, the state requires that a certain number of the subscribers need to meet some standard. You need to be in an environmental justice community or you need to be low income. In the first round on the Massachusetts program, what the state was finding was that they didn't have the level of participation from low-income communities that they were hoping to have. Now, this is not unusual. Hmm. So to the state's credit, what they did was they opened it up and they asked for more input in terms of how are we going to fix it. So this concept of being able to bake it in from the beginning and being open to sort of experimentation and listening to the actual residents who they're working to benefit is definitely an exciting way of governance.
Jean Herb is the executive director of the Environmental Analysis and Communications Group at Rutgers University and lead author on a new report looking at equity in state climate policies in the Northeast. Jean, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.